From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Britain's Prime Minister is forced into an embarrassing apology as his former spin doctor is found guilty of phone hacking.
I'm extremely sorry that I employed him. It was the wrong decision. I accepted his assurances. I gave him a job. It was a second chance. It turns out to be a bad decision, and I'm extremely sorry about that.
Also today, as John Kerry calls for unity in Iraq, we assess the implications for the Middle East. And we look at reports a Sudanese woman who narrowly escaped death row has been rearrested as she attempted to fly to the US.
So there's some confusion really over why the powerful security body would rearrest her, but she is, as I speak to you, still in detention, as are her family.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is urging Kurdish leaders in northern Iraq to support moves to encourage a unified government in Baghdad. Some Kurdish leaders are considering using the crisis to establish an independent state, as our Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
As America's top diplomat John Kerry meets with all the major political leaders in Iraq, the president of the Kurdish regional government has told the media during his meeting with Kerry that the country is facing a new reality. Masoud Barzani has previously hinted at a possible move to establish independence, just as the Sunni extremist group operating between Iraq and Syria known as ISIS has taken control of large swathes of a northwestern segment of the country. Some US officials have suggested that a move towards independence by the Kurds would exacerbate the sectarian divide in Iraq and are hoping for a political resolution that's inclusive.
The British Prime Minister's former head of communications, Andy Coulson, has been found guilty of conspiring to hack mobile phones. The former editor of the now-defunct News of the World newspaper, Rebecca Brooks, was cleared of all charges at the hacking trial. Our UK correspondent, Dan Whitehead, is outside the Old Bailey Court in London.
Well, just moments after the verdicts were handed down here at the Old Bailey, Rebecca Brooks left the court hand in hand alongside her husband, Charlie Brooks, surrounded by hundreds of members of the media, cameras flashing around her as she got into a black cab and sped away. She, of course, has been cleared of all charges here relating to the hacking trial. However, the former head of communications for the Prime Minister, David Cameron, Andy Coulson, has been found guilty of conspiring to hack phones. Juries here found him guilty of hacking phones with others between 2000 and 2006.
A Sudanese woman who recently escaped the death penalty for marrying a Christian man has been rearrested while trying to flee the country. Miriam Ibrahim was sentenced to death under Sharia law for abandoning Islam. She gave birth to her second child while in jail, and her harsh sentence prompted international outcry, pressure that contributed to Sudanese authorities releasing her on Monday. Ms. Ibrahim's husband is an American citizen. The family tried to leave for the U.S. after Ms. Ibrahim's release, but she was taken back into custody at the airport by 40 security agents. James Copenall, former BBC Sudan correspondent, says there's confusion surrounding the arrest.
Miriam Ibrahim's lawyers say they don't know why they were arrested. And indeed, a senior official from the government said he wasn't sure either. So there's some confusion, really, over why the powerful security body would rearrest her, but she is, as I speak to you, still in detention, as are her family.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russian President Vladimir Putin has asked the Russian parliament to revoke the right for the Russian military to intervene in Ukraine. The move comes after Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's announcement of a ceasefire, which some pro-Russian separatist leaders in the east of the country have reportedly agreed to. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The move, says President Putin's press secretary, is designed to normalize the situation in eastern Ukraine. Pro-Russian rebels have been fighting Ukrainian government troops there for weeks, with hundreds of reported civilian and military casualties and thousands reportedly fleeing the violence. The upper house of the Russian parliament authorized the use of force across all the territory of Ukraine on March 1st, shortly before Russia annexed the Ukrainian peninsula off Crimea. In response, some of those Russian politicians from the upper house involved in the passing of the measure had sanctions imposed on them by the U.S.
And 168 children have been rescued by authorities investigating child sex trafficking in the U.S. The FBI says 281 alleged pimps were arrested in the week-long sting. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
Dubbed Operation Cross Country, the sting involved 400 law enforcement agencies across more than 100 US cities. Some of the children had been sold online. FBI Director James Comey said, "These are not faraway kids in faraway lands. These are America's children, and our children are not for sale." The FBI said the youngsters would be given therapy and medical attention. Many of them had formerly been part of the child welfare system, but no one had reported them missing. This was the eighth such operation by the FBI, which has recovered nearly 3,600 children over 11 years.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I accepted his assurances. I gave him a job. It was a second chance. It turns out to be a bad decision, and I'm extremely sorry about that. But I would say that he didn't, in the work he did for me out before I became Prime Minister, or indeed as Prime Minister, people haven't complained about that work. But still, employing someone when they gave false assurances was the wrong decision. I'm profoundly sorry about that.
Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron forced into an embarrassing apology today after his former communications chief was found guilty in the UK's phone hacking trial. Andy Coulson, once editor of the Rupert Murdoch paper, The News of the World, worked for David Cameron at Downing Street in 2010 before being forced to resign as the phone hacking scandal snowballed. Mr. Cameron's friend Rebecca Brooks, the former chief executive of News International, was cleared of all charges. Our London correspondent Ollie Barrett has been speaking to journalist Peter Jukes, who has been in court for every single day of the trial and has written a book, The Inside Story of the Phone Hacking Trial. Outside the Old Bailey, London Central Criminal Court, Ollie began by asking him about the scale of the legal proceedings.
You've got a gathering of legal talent which will never come together again because you have seven defendants. Six of those have privately paid for defence. So you have the best talent of the generation on vast sums of money playing out this drama for 8 months in the Old Bailey. It's unprecedented.
And has it felt glamorous or seedy? What kind of atmosphere has there been inside the trial?
Well, there are moments of glamour, obviously, when Jude Law, Sienna Miller turns up, and archbishops and archdeacons, and you have very well-known, well-connected defendants, you know. Andy Coulson, former press supremo for David Cameron, Rebecca Brooks, friends with the last three prime ministers, and obviously close to Rupert Murdoch.
This is a case that has connections to the very highest office in the land.
Well, absolutely, it has connections to the last three prime ministers, but particularly Tony Blair, who arrived in evidence, and obviously Coulson and Cameron. It also has connections to the biggest, I think now, the biggest media company in the world. Before there was split anyway, News Corp, 21st Century Fox, and an amazing businessman, you know, has 50-year track record, Rupert Murdoch. It touches on every aspect of life, from sports stars to actors to murders, crime. It's just, you know, all human life was there. I mean, what is clear from the evidence is that it was quite well known in the legal system and in News International that post 2006, when Mulcair and Goodman were arrested, that this was not a sole case. He was not a rogue reporter. There's been plenty of evidence of a cover-up of that. How Cameron did not know that, with lots of warnings coming his way, is very difficult to think. And even more so when he went into government in 2010, where we know there were specific warnings about, you know, the culture of phone hacking under Coulson's editorship. So I think there'll be questions asked about his judgment and quite why he was close to both Coulson and Rebecca Brooks.
In terms of Coulson and Brooks, these are people who have risen right to the top of their professions. Incredibly successful people, powerful people. How have they seemed inside the court? Have they seemed confident or rattled or nervous? A mixture of all of those things.
A mixture of all those things. I must say Brooks was amazing. She was on the stand for 5 weeks and she really never cracked, lost her charm. She just looked tired at times. Coulson had a much more difficult time in the witness box. But again, though, he looked very jaded and worn. He never quite, you know, broke it. But there wasn't that, you know, moment in A Few Good Men, Jack Nicholson, you can't handle the truth. And, you know, you spend 8 months with these people. You get to see them every day. You get to like them. I think it's been very, very tough for them. It's a long, long process.
You say you've got to like them. Do you have different feelings about these people now than you did a few months ago?
I had met Brooks before, and she was very charming. I think the point of this whole trial, it's about culture. I don't think the individuals are necessarily bad, you know. Bad, good people can do bad things. And I think it's much more about a culture of stories at any price, political leverage, which led to a culture of lawbreaking. Well, what is revealed in evidence, you know, quite apart from the verdicts, is a system that got toxic and out of hand. I mean, the random little details you discover, like, you know, going to visit David Blunkett and saying, I won't run your name in the paper of the name of your lover, and then the Sun running it the next day. News of the World approaching Sophie Wessex and saying, give us an exclusive interview and we won't run a story, a fake shake story of a sting. And they run it anyway, of pen pals for prisoners to get stories out of them, of the casual tracing and following of people and accessing their medical records, of betraying sources, of kind of this industrial process, which really didn't give a damn about privacy and really didn't, was above any ethical standard. It shows to me the danger of monopoly. I mean, Britain has a very monopolized press compared with America, which is a stable oligopoly. And they actually have in America more laws over free speech to protect it by not allowing concentration of ownership. That's why Rupert Murdoch's an American citizen, rather than Australian or British. That's why he had to sell the New York Post, he wanted a TV station. We seem to have none of these laws protecting freedom and diversity of speech. And I think ownership is a key issue.
FSN's Ollie Barrett with journalist Peter Jukes, author of the book The Inside Story of the Phone Hacking Trial. This is FSN Reports. A Sudanese woman has reportedly been rearrested just 24 hours after being freed from death row. Miriam Ibrahim, along with her two children and her husband, an American citizen, were thought to be travelling to the United States from an airport in Sudan's capital. The US State Department said an issue over travel documents had resulted in her detention, insisting the US was working with Sudan to secure their safe travel. Miriam Ibrahim had been sentenced to hang after a Sudanese court found her guilty of abandoning the Muslim faith earlier this year. An appeals court later overturned the ruling. James Copnell is a former BBC Sudan correspondent and author of the book A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter and Incomplete Divorce.
Miriam Ibrahim had been released and that had been celebrated many places around the world and many places in Sudan too. But as she and her family were at the airport, they were arrested by officers from Sudan's security services. Miriam Ibrahim's lawyers say they don't know why they were arrested. And indeed, a senior official from the government said he wasn't sure either. So there's some confusion, really, over why the powerful security body would rearrest her. But she is, as I speak to you, still in detention, as are her family.
And James, can you remind us of the ordeal that Miriam Ibrahim suffered prior to today's confusing events?
Well, she'd been in jail for some time. She's accused of both adultery and of leaving the Islamic religion to become a Christian. She and her supporters said that she was a Christian who had married a South Sudanese American man who's a Christian too. It wasn't a question of adultery. Now, that wasn't recognized initially by Sudanese law, and she faced death. She was on death row. She also gave birth to a baby while in jail, reportedly while still shackled, and initially it had been thought that she'd be allowed to look after that child for 2 years before being put to death. That was then until an appeals court released her, said that the charges were baseless, and it had been felt that maybe the entire saga, which had drawn headlines around the world, was over. But then, of course, as she attempted to leave the country, she was rearrested.
James, going back to what you mentioned earlier regarding the National Intelligence and Security Service, can you tell us a bit more about their role in Sudan?
Yeah, well, NIS, as it's widely known, is a very powerful body, very feared body too, that human rights groups often accuse it of abuses of the people it arrests, but it also plays a very big role in Sudanese politics. And essentially, there's a sort of unwieldy coalition of people who really govern Sudan. So it's a mix of Islamists, people who strongly believe in political Islam, and other politicians who may pay lip service to Islamism but are more pragmatic in their approach. And then thirdly, there's the military. And finally, there are the security services. And these four elements are constantly in competition with each other for prominence. And in recent times, the security services seem to have been elbowing their way to the forefront and looking to push their weight around a bit in the decision-making process. But that's one of the complicated things about Sudanese politics. It's unclear, really, at any given point, who's in charge, whose decision will be respected.
James Copnell, former BBC Sudan correspondent. Now, as the Islamist insurgency in Iraq continues, John Kerry took his message of unity in the face of the aggression to the country's north. The US Secretary of State was meeting with Kurdish leaders as sentiment for independence from Iraq grows in the semi-autonomous region. Today's FSN Spotlight explores just how the current unrest will impact the Middle East. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, a look at the broader regional implications of the Iraq conflict. As ISIS militants continue to make gains in Iraq, they also have ambitions of establishing a fundamentalist caliphate that would incorporate Syria and possibly other parts of the Middle East as well. So how far can they go? Abdel Bari Atwan is the editor-in-chief of Rai Al-Yum. It's often described as the Arab world's answer to the Huffington Post. And he told Juliet Foster of Arise News that he believes ISIS has no intention of stopping at Iraq's borders.
Yes, could destabilize Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf region, you know, the whole of the Middle East now in turmoil because of ISIS. ISIS is very strong, well-trained. They managed to defeat the Iraqi army where billions of dollars spent to arm and train. So it is like an earthquake happening in the Middle East now. Everybody is scared of ISIS and they don't know what to do. John Kerry is going there trying to salvage something, but the American broke it and they should fix it. But are they going to fix it? The problem is it will be very costly for them. They lost about 5,000 soldiers, about $1 trillion in Iraq. So I don't know what he's trying to do. He's lecturing them that you should get rid of sectarianism, you should work together, but it is more difficult than that.
But when you actually look at the ISIS gains, there is the argument that they've only been able to make these advances because they've been joining forces with the remnants of Saddam Hussein's own military, but also as well the tribal Sunni groups, that without those factors, perhaps, the advance wouldn't be quite so progressive.
You are absolutely correct. It is a deadly cocktail. You know, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the people, they are very ideologistic, very radical. And then you have the experience of ex-Saddam Hussein officers and you have the tribes behind them. So this deadly cocktail is now advancing and moving. And they manage, imagine 1,500 of them managed to defeat about 30,000 soldiers of al-Malik, of Iraqi armies. So people in the Middle East are really so scared that this ISIS and its deadly cocktail could threaten the whole region.
I mean, the other element that's been thrown into this, of course, is Muqtada al-Assad. Now, he's reformed his Mahdi army, and he's pretty confident that he can take on the ISIS threat. So how many fighters would he have at his disposal? And is he being delusional when he says, well, look, you know, I can defeat them?
The problem is, it is not actually the numbers of fighters. It is the experience. It is the will. That's what counts in Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. ISIS is very strong, well-trained, and self-sufficient of arms because they put their hands on piles of weapons in Iraq and also in Syria.
And money from the bank robberies.
Exactly. They've got about, you know, $500 million from the banks in Mosul and Tikrit and other cities which they captured. So that when they are self-sufficient, when they got the money, they can recruit more people and they can train them. So Muqtada al-Sadr Yes, his army is very strong and he can recruit maybe 100,000 to 100,000. But the problem is, why should he recruit? You have an Iraqi army, 900,000, and billions of dollars spent to train and arm this army. So why should we have another militias? This will be extremely dangerous. This will dismember the country, and this actually will create a huge sectarian rift, which we cannot bridge in the near future. This is the danger. If al-Mahdi army is there, al-Maliki army is there, and others, Shia and Sunni armies are there, militias. So it will be anarchy, and it will be very, very costly.
I mean, we know what the strategy is with ISIS to set up this caliphate, but in terms of how they're doing it, first they worked in Syria. They manipulated the dispute there to actually gain some key areas in that country. They've now moved into Baghdad. Is there a sense of, okay, or rather Iraq, Baghdad is a target, but presumably what is the next country in the pact that they're aiming at?
You know, the first thing, they would like to consolidate their grip on Mosul and Raqqa in Syria. So one piece in Iraq, one piece in Syria, or one government in Iraq, one other one in Syria. So they want to consolidate their grip there. And north of Iraq, also south, east of Syria. If they've done that, after that, they will expand. Jordan is very close. And so Saudi Arabia is very close.
But would Jordan, which would be the next logical target, Jordan or Saudi Arabia?
I think the most logical target is Jordan, simply because Jordan, now they are nearly in the border of Jordan. They managed to control border crossing between Jordan and Iraq. So after that, they could be closer to Israel. And this actually will create a huge changes in the Middle East. Yesterday, we had a car bomb in Golan Heights, inside, which occupied by Israelis. An Israeli soldier and three others were, an Israeli soldier was killed and three others were injured. It is the first incident of its size, of its kind. So it means ISIS now is moving toward Israel, moving toward
Jordan.
And
they're emboldening other groups operating in that region.
And you know, the problem is that they are like a magnet. They are actually attracting a lot of frustrated young Arabs, young Muslims to join their ranks. This is the most important thing.
But doesn't that mean that even though the American position has been one of, look, we can't afford to get involved, which we can't politically or perhaps economically, some would say, that they're going to get sucked into this anyway, if not in Iraq, certainly increasing the amount of aid, for example, they give to the likes of Israel and also to the likes of Jordan and working with the Saudis. So they're going to get sucked in whether they like it or not.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, because, you know, that the conflict area is enlarging day by day. And they don't know what to do. They don't want to be involved because their finger were burned in Iraq, in Afghanistan. So they are now trying to adopt the tactic of using drones, you know, pilotless, you know, flights.
Yeah.
So if they do so, but it means they will kill a lot of innocent people, like what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And swell the number of the crews.
This is the problem. Unless you have troops on the ground, you cannot achieve anything. Or if you achieve, you achieve little thing. This is the dilemma facing the American. The whole Middle East is disintegrating because of their stupid intervention in Iraq, which is illegal intervention there. So they open a Pandora box, and this is flowing in the whole region. Now they are going back to Iraq after 10 years. They thought it would be democracy, prosperity. It wasn't, simply because they chose the wrong people, and they adopted the sectarian division, sectarian government. That's the problem.
But given what is happening now and the potential for what could happen in the future, do you think that the fall of Baghdad is inevitable, or does Baghdad still have the resources, the means to actually hold out?
Baghdad is a big fish. I don't believe ISIS will have the capabilities to attack Baghdad and control it. It's extremely difficult because also Baghdad is multi-sectarian. You have Shia, you have Sunni, and it is a huge city. They need, you know, a huge army to conquer Baghdad. So, but the problem is, you know, they are now in the border of Baghdad. They are taking cities there, towns there. So it will be
a very gradual approach.
Yes. It will be a long war and very costly.
But given the money that they've got, I mean, they are a very wealthy organization and the resources that they have at their disposal, in a sense, they can afford to play the long game.
Oh, yes, they can. Now, the problem, and they have, you know, they have the tribes who are supporting them. They have the Sunni who are frustrated after 10 years of sectarian ruling there. Al-Maliki did not actually promote the coexistence between the Sunni and the Shia. He actually consolidated all the powers between his hands. So this actually helps ISIS. process to recruit those frustrated Sunni who are now against Maliki and against his government. But if Maliki stepped down, if we manage to have a national unity government, which is, you know, above the sectarianism, in this case, we could have some hope.
That's Abdel Bari Atwan, the editor-in-chief of Rai Al Youm. He was talking there to Juliet Foster of Arise News. It's online at www.arise.tv. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And finally today, here in the United States, new viewing figures show that America is now not just a soccer-playing country, it's a soccer-watching country as well. Sunday's USA-Portugal game was watched by a record 18 million viewers in the USA, with sports broadcaster ESPN calling it the network's biggest ever audience for a sporting event, other than NFL and college football. Meanwhile, the shadow of corruption continues to hang over world soccer. FIFA, the sport's governing body, says it's evaluating allegations that one of its senior officials was caught up in a British newspaper's match-fixing sting. Tim Lamb is the chair of Britain's Sports Betting Group, which aims to keep soccer corruption-free, and he says FIFA needs to take the threat of match-fixing more seriously.
Unfortunately, this is just the latest in a long line of allegations and even proved instances of match fixing across international football. And this is something which Michel Platini and Jacques Rogge and various other luminaries within the world of international sport have described as even more serious than doping. So it is something that the world of sport, governments and law enforcement agencies really need to get a grip of.
They're not doing very well to date, are they, Mr. Lamb?
Well, I think as far as the UK is concerned, in the heavily regulated betting markets in this country, it's fair to say that match fixing, of the type that's alleged in this instance, is still relatively rare. But as the Sports Betting Group, we've been calling on the government to take the issue more seriously. Your listeners may be interested to know that match-fixing itself is not actually a criminal offence under the Gambling Act.
So how do we drill down to the bottom of all of this, in your view?
Well, I think FIFA, as the International Federation, needs to take the issue more seriously. There's got to be really close collaboration between sports governing bodies, governments across international borders, and also law enforcement agencies. But, you know, we've written to the government to say that it's very important that match-fixing is now designated as a criminal offence under the auspices of the Gambling Act. And I think everybody just needs to wake up to the fact that this is a massive issue for international sport, and that unless the public feel that they're watching fair competition played between people who are really genuinely competing to win, it does sound the death knell for sport.
And just lastly, on a related issue, the Qatar hosting of the World Cup, how do you view that?
Well, as a personal view, I did find it absolutely extraordinary that they should have allocated the World Cup to Qatar. There's no legacy of football there. There's no real background of football. Obviously, like you, I've read the allegations of corruption there as yet unproven. But how ridiculous to organise a tournament during the summer months when temperatures can get to 50 degrees centigrade. So, you know, the whole situation surrounding the award of the World Cup to Qatar seemed to me personally extraordinary, and that seems to have been compounded by all the allegations surrounding the award of the competition. But let's see how FIFA's anti-corruption expert sees it when he publishes a report later in the year.
Tim Lamb, the chair of Britain's Sports Betting Group, talking to LBC Radio. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Wednesday, the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States and why they're optimistic a new age of political stability and transparency can be achieved in Ukraine. That's Wednesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.